Grande Italia, grande, grande!
I'm Gab, he's Jules. It's cloudy in West London, but hey, it's July in London. That's normal, right?
Yeah.
But it's okay. We have a new European champion.
Yeah, well done.
I only played a small part. I hasten to add, yes, Italy Euro 2020 champions beating England on penalties at Wembley last night. We'll talk a little bit of Copa America later. We'll have some quick hits, but we got to start there. And who better than somebody who knows their English football and their Italian football inside out? It's Stuart Robson. Robbo, welcome aboard. Tell me what you saw in the final. How did Mancini turn the game around after going a goal down? Again, some stats are used, 62% possession. Italy took 20 shots on goal. England had one shot on target the entire game. I presume that was Luke Shaw's goal. Mm-hmm. How did he do it? Was it substitutions? Che passò?
I didn't think he had to do too much because I thought he was going to have a problem if England pressed the ball high up the field. But I thought England's system made it much, much easier for Italy because Italy had 3-2 in midfield, and that's exactly what they wanted. I'd seen Italy play against Austria and struggle. I'd seen Italy play against Spain, who pressed them high up the field and didn't allow Jorginho time to pick out pass or get space on the ball. And England, after that first 10 minutes, when they got their tactics right in terms of pressing the ball, suddenly went on the defensive. And then Italy, which they're good at doing, they could pick their passes. There was good rotation in midfield. They could find their out balls into the wide players. And although they didn't create chances in that first half or the start of the second half, they started to control the game. And once they controlled the game, England never got back into it. Italy were deserved winners.
I appreciate Robbo going in hard on England. We'll get to that in a second. Jules, I thought the substitutions, you know, bringing in the fresh legs, bringing in players who maybe aren't superstars. Because I noticed at one point, right, you had out there on the pitch, you have Berardi who plays for Sassuolo. Mm. You had Belotti who plays for a Torino side that nearly got relegated. You have Bernardeschi who's like 27th choice at Juve. You had Emerson who's third choice at Chelsea. These are the dudes who were out there. And I thought one of the key decisions that he made was when he took off Ciro Immobile. It was having a really difficult game.
Tough game, yeah.
Brought on Insigne and the half-Canadian Brian Cristante, I hasten to add to my Berardi. Friends north of the border. And Berardi Cristante, yeah. And all of a sudden, Italy moved Insigne into the middle. Mm. They had effectively that diamond. And all of a sudden, it just felt like England just moved deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper.
Yeah, and could not get the ball back. And I think it shows as well, and we will talk about Southgate and England later, but if you have the structure, you can bring players who are maybe not the most talented or certainly not the most gifted, but they will fit in that structure. They know exactly what to do. They had a clear plan on how to play around England, how to go and create something, put Chiesa in the right positions, have Verratti dominating and bossing the midfield and dictating the tempo of the game, which they did in the second half. And England never came back from it. Yes, they had a little bit of moments there and there where they tried to put a bit more pressure, but this was it. And I think it shows you that one team had a proper plan and the other one scored early and had no plan after that.
Yeah, Robbo, on that point, to me, there's two elements. There's Southgate's plan and the personnel. I want to hasten to add, I think I really like and respect Southgate as a person. I think he's done a really important job. Yeah. However, I don't understand his football. Jules and I have been saying it, especially Jules, throughout this tournament. Is playing defensive, and then you go even more defensive in the final. You decide to play a fullback like Kieran Trippier, instead of another attacking midfielder, stroke winger. And I go back to this. At some point, 10 years from now, 15 years from now, kids are going to be asking, hey, granddad, is it true that Jadon Sancho, Phil Foden, and Marcus Rashford were all on this, you know, who at that point would all be old guys retiring after stellar careers, were all in the squad and they hardly ever played? How do you explain that?
Well, I can't explain it. When we were doing the build-up to the game and I'm looking at it and suddenly we see he's gone to a back three and Trippier's going to play at right-sided wing-back, I still couldn't understand why he would do it. The only reason I could give was that maybe he felt as though Insigne coming in off the touchline and Immobile trying to run down the side of John Stones, if he had Walker as the third centre-half, who's been excellent through the tournament, he could cope with that and he could then push Emerson back by playing Trippier a bit higher down the right-hand side. But the logic was that he had to play the same system as the previous game, press Italy high up the field, match them in that central area, and not give them any chance to build up their play. Because if they went locked from back to front, Italy weren't very good because Immobile is not good but with his back to goal. He couldn't hold up the play. And you're absolutely right, Gab. When he brought on the substitutes, Berardi came on, they had Chiesa still on the field, and then Belotti and before that Insigne. They were players that could run with the ball. They were players that could make things happen. So I think Mancini got his tactics right and was able to adapt. And Jules is absolutely right. For 3 years, they played the same system. They just changed the personnel. And each player that comes into the Italian side knows what his job is, whoever it may be. And that's brilliant management from Mancini.
Now, we're going to get into this in a much more granular way. We're going to break things down, the penalties, the stuff that happened. But I want to just, well, we'll get into that in the Gavin Jules podcast. But I want to hit now what happened before the game and during the game, because this really surprised me. I was inside the stadium early, so I knew what happened there. Robbo, you were outside at the start of the game. You had the post with Alexis Nunes. You saw what was happening on Wembley Way. And I'm talking about the amount of just horrendous antisocial behavior that was happening. And then the concern as well when a bunch of ticketless fans, and initially they had the gall to deny it. It's like, oh no, there's been no security breach.
No one got in.
Yeah, okay. So yeah, you could look around the stadium, you could see the gangways were packed with people, the walkways were packed with people, right? Thank goodness that capacity was reduced, because I know people who they were allowed into the game late because they closed the doors, and then they were made to reseat somewhere else because people were sitting in their seats. I don't expect this in England. I'm not talking about the fan behavior, because unfortunately we've seen that. I'm talking about the complete lack of organization, the bad policing on the night, the bad stewarding at Wembley. And I don't blame the stewards. I blame the people who are in charge of them. Robbo, tell us what you saw and how did this happen?
Well, I saw it in the game against Germany and I saw it in the semi-final. There was more than the allotted amount of people at the games. You know, when you look at the German game, it's meant to be 45,000 there. There was 65,000 there. You could tell, you look around the stadium, there's not that many empty seats. People, there was orchestrated ways of trying to get into the stadium yesterday. But it was the antisocial behaviour. And I'm not talking by a handful of people, by most of the people. I arrived 5 hours before the game. There's people lying on the street with cuts and bruises. They're drunk. They're out of order. They try and ram or storm the co-op opposite from where we were to try and get more drink. They had to shut the shop. They're trying to storm the Italian restaurant just down below us. It was unbelievable. I've never seen anything anywhere near as bad as that.
And Robbo, I'm just going to jump in. You say you've never seen anything. I just want to make it clear. You played football in England in the 70s and 80s, and you're telling me you've never seen anything like that?
Well, I saw in the 80s, I think I played in a semi-final, Arsenal against Manchester United, where there was fighting on the streets between the two sets of fans. And then it would break up. It wasn't good. It was horrible stuff. Yesterday, I at the end of the game, I was worried to go back out onto the streets to get to my car, which was probably a mile away. And I had to have two bodyguards to get me there because of the things that were taking place down below us. The best thing that happened on the evening was that England lost the game and it rained. And that dampened the atmosphere afterwards. Otherwise, we'd have had a real problem.
Yeah,
It's crazy because this is a team and a squad who made this country so proud and did so many great things. And yet, right at the end, some of those idiotic fans went and ruined it all and shamed their own country.
I was not expecting this. I mean, there is a group of fans who follow England regularly. And by the way, I know it might have been different on the day. Weirdly, there's a lot of 40-somethings with shaven heads and stuff like that. It's not, at least in the past, it wasn't. You know, people in their 20s, in the recent past, I'm talking. I find this, I was really surprised at the lack of preparation, and I really hope there is an inquiry, because we still don't know if really bad things could have happened, but there were people with kids there. People could have gotten very hurt. Yes, policemen could have gotten hurt. Stewards there getting paid minimum wage and given a little orange bib, having to go and deal with this crap. That's just unacceptable.
Sorry, Gab, can I just go back to that? We saw fireworks being thrown at the police. We saw flares being thrown at the police. We saw the police, and there was probably about 10 of them at one point, trying to break something up, being surrounded and had to walk away from it because they were going to be in danger. That cannot happen.
I didn't want to dwell on the negatives there, but I felt we had to report what happened because we were there. We have firsthand accounts, and this can't happen again. But before I let you guys go and give Southgate a hard time again for his tactical choices, again, let me reemphasize, as a person, I think we all really respect and admire what he's done. It's really important. I want to some positives about Italy, because I think it's something personal. For me, and I tweeted a picture out before the game, I got goosebumps when I saw Gianluca Vialli, who I've known for 25 years. We've written two books together. He lives around the corner from me in London. You know, sort of an hour and a half before kickoffs, the teams come out, they walk around the pitch, you kind of get acclimated. They all go back in, and he's standing there for what felt like forever in the middle of the pitch. He's got his little white hat on. He's looking around. I just thought of, you know, what he must have been thinking, his memories associated with Wembley.
Of course, the 1992
European Cup final, when he took little, he and Roberto Mancini, of course, took little Sampdoria all the way there. They lost to Barcelona, the goal from your buddy Ronald Koeman. Pep Guardiola, I think, might have been there as well.
Yeah.
Or even the 96 FA Cup final, when Ruud Gullit very kindly put him on with 1 minute to go when they were 2-0 up. And that really warmed my heart, because I know how important this experience is. And then after the game, fast forward a few hours, I get home and got home around, about 1:30 or something. And, you know, and I flick on the TV. Obviously, you're not going to go to bed. You pour yourself a beer and you sit down and you watch. And everybody went back to this. And it often feels trite. I did this quote from Bonucci, which I put in my piece, which said, like, the atmosphere is such that normally when you go to a training camp, you know, even if you're doing well, you miss home, you want to leave. The atmosphere that they've created here is such an incredible team ambiance, an incredible team environment, to the point that even on those days off when they had their families visit them, the players all just wanted to hang out together. And it kind of annoyed some of the wives and girlfriends. And I thought that was remarkable, because, you know, we were asked to choose the outstanding player from Italy. I really struggled to pick out one guy. Like, I think it's really difficult. At different moments, you could say Bonucci, right. You could say Chiesa, you could say Donnarumma, you could say Chiellini, you could say Jorginho. And I think that's interesting. And where I'm going with this is, we knew Mancini is a good tactical manager. His rep, and if you listen to people at Manchester City, especially those people in the Manchester City press office who like to tell you behind the scenes stuff, you would think that he was a spawn of Satan when he was there, right? Robbo, do you think, from the outside, is it an evolution in man management? Has Mancini grown? Can you still grow in, you know, from the time, from what he is now, when he's 56, 55?
But don't forget, it's different to have a national team when you see the players more sporadically than a club team where you're there all the time and you see the same people every day for the whole season. Just before Robbo answers.
Yeah, Robbo, is this a big deal?
Yes, I think as a manager you can develop, but you can become a better man manager. And it's also the people, and you just mentioned Vialli, the people underneath him. You know, as Steve McClaren always talked about his time at Manchester United, it wasn't so much about managing the players, it was about, or coaching the players, it was also about managing the manager, making sure he doesn't upset the players, and you have to be the link between the manager and the players. And that's what I'm sure Vialli and the other coaching staff have done very well for Mancini. But Mancini has done everything right. He's built a side from nothing, really. Italy were going nowhere. In 2018, I looked at their players and thought, they haven't got a great set of players. How are they going to develop? He's developed them as a team. And Jules talked about it earlier. They've got a game plan that they know and like. And the different personnel come in and play it very well. And he's also got that camaraderie. And I think you've also got, in Chiellini, one of the inspirational players that's ever been. You know, his leadership, he's the way he's always got a smile on his face, the way he gets around other players when the goalkeeper makes a save, he's banging him on the chest. If a fullback makes a tackle, he's running over and patting him on the head. That inspires people. Chiellini and Bonucci have been brilliant.
Yeah, and I'm holding my hands up here officially. As you know, I did not expect Bonucci and Chiellini. I was sure that one was going to get hurt, the other one was going to sent off, they're going to do something silly. I mean, certainly you look at Chiellini's horse collar tackle on Saka. You know, did it remind you of, like, you know, when you're in the playground and there's a little kid running away and, like, you know, one of the parents just grabs him, you know, from behind.
Exactly. But two things here. Sorry, Gab. One, team spirit wins you trophies or certainly helps you going far. And we saw it with England, who have a very good togetherness and team spirit that Southgate has built. And that's one of the credit we will talk later about Southgate, but that's one of the good things he's done. Denmark had the same, and you could go to Croatia in 2018, had the same. You need talent on the pitch as well, but I think that team spirit is a big part of it. And then, and we've said it on the show before, and I'm going to repeat it again, I never ever want anyone to tell me again that you cannot have an identity as a national team, which is something that comes back all the time. Oh, they don't even have time to, they don't have enough time to work together, so you can't have a DNA at the national team. It's not like a club. What Mancini has done with his team is being like a club. He's playing like a team club. He's having the team spirit of a team club. He's having the organization of a team club. So please, never again the lack of, or no, international football is too hard to have an identity, a style of,
well, it's
a style
more
of play.
Well, I think it's more difficult, but what is more remarkable here, and I agree with
but
you.
But he's done it, so, you know, a lot of people can do it.
Well, but the thing is,
being first.
The thing is, it's not just that they have an identity, it's that they have an identity which goes against 100 years of the Italian national team.
Of course.
That to me, Robbo, is the really remarkable part here. You watch them play, they're trying to play like a Manchester City, like a Bayern Munich, with generally worse players.
Like
they're trying
Spain.
Or like a Spain, yeah, with less gifted players. You can say they're playing to their strength because the gifted players they have are midfield, whatever. But, you know, man for man, this is what it is. And this runs completely counter, except maybe there was a period with Prandelli where they tried to do that. Mm. Although, again, that was different. They had better strikers. You had Balotelli in his prime, who, you know, was devastating at the time. But this is what I find so remarkable. And it's now 34 games unbeaten, playing this way, being courageous, taking the game to the opposition. Robbo, you know how important culture and what people are used to is. What do you make of it?
All I can say, he's done a brilliant job. And when he went in, he said, this is the way I'm going to play. This is how we're going to play as a national team. Well, it's almost a back four, but it's a back three with our wing back getting forward down the left-hand side. It means we can get the best out of Insigne coming in field. We're going to play with somebody high and wide on the right-hand side so we can switch the play out there. We've got to try and dominate midfield. That's why I'm going to play with the likes of Jorginho. And although Verratti's a very similar player, the two of those are going to play together. Barella, who's developed, is the sort of player that can make those forward runs. And when that doesn't happen, as you mentioned earlier, Cristante, we'll bring him on. And who would say Cristante is a forward-running midfield player? That's not how he plays for Roma, but he was able to fit into the system because Mancini's done it day in, day out, and every player in the team knows what his job is in that formation. And that's been the brilliant thing for me about Mancini and Italy. And that's why I was so desperate for them to do well in this tournament.
Before the tournament, you know, when we talked about favourites and everything and we went through all the teams and stuff, and I said to you about Italy, I did think that not having a really good striker, because we all like Immobile, and yes, in Serie A, he's had some amazing season. He's scored more than, 25 goals in the last five seasons. So he's a great striker. But in this competition, he wasn't. You know, I don't care about the goals he scored in group stages against Turkey and Wales or whatever. Mm. But for Italy to go and win this competition without a striker, France did it in 98. We had Givash and Dugarry, and they were not good.
But France did it in 2018 too.
So. Oh, come on. Okay. But to the point of finding other ways of scoring, whether that's Barella, whether that's Chiesa, whether that's a set piece like in the final, whether that's the Chiesa goal in the semi-final against Spain, where you play on the counter and he gets the ball and then it's on his own individual brilliance. I think in itself, that's a skill. Because if you have a Harry Kane or Lukaku who's going to score you guaranteed, or even Cristiano, 5 goals a tournament, at least you don't have to worry about that, because you know that if you create the chances and you serve them, they're going to score. Now, Mancini almost had to say, okay, Immobile, we were hoping for a great tournament for him. It's not there. We have to find other ways of scoring. Otherwise, we're not going to go and win it. And they did.
I think that's a really good point, and it's a good natural transition, I think, to talking about England. Because when Southgate decided to go into it with this approach, which I thought was actually even more conservative than in 2018. Let's not forget, the England side in 2018 was a worse side than this one. Yeah, player for player. Yeah. You know, I mean, you had Jesse Lingard and whatever, right? Part of the thinking was, and you know, those people who brief you, those people who get paid to plant stories and from paid by the FA, they say that, well, look, France won by being defensive and counterattacking and being solid at the back, not conceding goals. That's how you win tournaments. Portugal won 2016 by playing that way. So this is how we're going to play. We'll just get it done and see it out that way. And I thought, this is really stupid. This is a really stupid way of thinking. Because First of all, teams that win tournaments inevitably always concede fewer goals, right? That's, you know, if you concede fewer goals or score more goals, then you win, right? So it's kind of one of those self-fulfilling prophecies. Yeah. But secondly, France, when France did it, you can say, oh, but they had Guivarch, who's functional, not that good. Yeah, Guivarch also had Thierry Henry, David Trezeguet around him. They had Zidane on the front foot, right?
Yeah.
Jorkaeff. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
2018, oh, look, it's Giroud. He's very handsome, but he's a big lug. Okay, fine. He also had Kylian Mbappe, Antoine Griezmann from 2018. These are pretty special players, yeah?
Of course.
England, I don't want to say Sancho and Sterling or and Kane are on a level with those guys. Kane, I think, is. But you had a range of people to choose from, but you didn't play them. You didn't even attempt to do that. You didn't attempt to go and do that. You know, you didn't have a Pogba. This is what I don't understand. You're not playing to your strengths. You're asking these guys, most of whom play for top clubs, most of whom play in attacking roles, used to ball being the other end. Okay, you guys, sit back and defend. You know, we'll score and we'll defend a lead and we'll try to hit on the break. Am I wrong here, Robbo? Isn't that one of the basic things, play to your strengths?
You're absolutely right, because England, in their passing, hardly created anything. They were so reliant on Sterling making a run forward, so reliant on Saka when he received the ball and getting turned and running with the ball. They were the only time that England looked threatening. Their passing wasn't creative enough.
What got me from the beginning, and I know Southgate is a really good guy. This is a great generation. They will be back in Qatar. They will be back in Germany in the next Euros. They're there for the next 15 years. It's no problem. I don't know how long Southgate will be there. But it's the cautiousness. There's a point where I can't deal with passivity.
Yeah.
Being passive on the touchline. I was watching him yesterday. He was on the touchline like this. I don't know why he was waiting, expecting. You knew that Mancini would try different things. How did you think that you could defend the lead for 88 minutes? Who does that? Why did you stop playing? You had this amazing first 2 minutes where you score. Go and capitalize on it. Go and try to score a second. The Italians were dizzy. They were knocked out. They were like, oh my God, final of the Euros. You 1-0 down after 2 minutes. Yeah. Go and keep putting pressure. Go and get a second. And yet, no, they went back and they played deeper and deeper. And there are no solution. And there was nothing, no patterns of play, nothing with the ball, no creativity, no ideas. The changes, the substitutions were dreadful. And don't get me starting on Henderson again. You bring someone in and then you took him off before the end of the game. Rashford and Sancho don't touch the ball and then you play me on just for the penalties. Why? Saka has a fifth penalty. I'm like, what? He messed that up so badly.
I thought Harry Kane in the first 45 minutes was unplayable. We were talking about this before off air. I thought, you know, I don't want to say this is Kane's best 45 minutes because I'm sure somebody will mention a time he scored a hat trick and I'm sure Kane's had a lot of great games. But I thought in those first 45 minutes, Kane was destroying Italy.
Like Dani Olmo for Spain. When you drop like
both
this.
Both ends. Exactly. Dropping, going deep, is passing.
Yeah.
And
first
I thought,
touch is amazing.
Capitalize on that.
Exactly.
Help him. No, I wasn't thinking that because I wanted the other team to win.
Yeah,
but logic would say capitalize on that. Help him. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong here, Robbo. What out ball? This is the other thing about choosing to defend. If you defend, you need to have an out ball, right? And yet, it's felt that the only out ball that they had was Raheem Sterling, who may be fast, but also he generally likes having the ball to feet.
Always.
Or Harry Kane, who the poor guy was running himself into the ground and had three players on him the whole time. Also, it's not like Kane's going to turn and run 80 yards. This is what I don't understand. You know tactics. If you defend, you have to have an out ball, right?
You have to have an out ball. And the problem is, if you defend for too long and you don't have the ball for long periods, when you do get it, you've got no idea. You can't get any rhythm to your play. And that's what happened with England. You know, they should have, right from the start of the game, pressed the ball, which they did for the first 5 minutes. They go and score their goal. And they should have pressed the ball. Italy would have struggled to get out. I couldn't see how Italy were going to get the ball into Immobile and Insigne and cause any problems. England had to press the ball. And why he went on the defensive, I do not know. I agree with Jules. I agree with you both. He's done a wonderful job in getting the media on side. He's done a wonderful job of making England a tournament team. He's made a wonderful job of making the England players want to play for England. He's still, in my view, a very poor coach. And I've said that for 4 or 5 years, since he was the head of development of England and the under-21 manager. I looked at what he did and always said he's not a top-class coach.
In the second half, when you knew already the end of the first half, Italy are on top by far. I mean, England after 20 minutes have disappeared with the ball. I'm screaming, Gab, in my house, I'm screaming at the television saying, do something, change something. You don't even have to change the personnel, but change your formation, even if you don't want to bring any other players on. And yet he waits for Bonucci to score the goal, to be 1-1, for Italy to be really on top, to go and bring Saka and Grealish on. Why not? Why didn't you think that earlier, when you could see that clearly the shift, the game has shifted, that the momentum was going Italy way, that Mancini had made some substitution that changed actually something structurally for Italy. And yet he was there watching, not doing anything. And like,
I don't understand.
I really didn't understand it.
I don't. As by nature, I don't criticize people for their body language, but it did feel very passive. And this is something that strikes me, because we praise Mancini for going against Italy's natural cautious defend and counter character that has marked their football for a long time. I felt Southgate went against England's character, right? I mean, I don't want to get all sort of sociological, historical on it, but, you know, England did have an empire. They like concrete people. They are aggressive players and so on.
But he went against the players he has in his... That's the worst, Gab. It's not just that. It's that he went against the players he has in his squad. He has all the talent there to play football.
Instead, he plays the less talented players.
Yeah, also.
I was saying before the game, if it comes down to a game of tactics and technical skill, it will be Italy that win. If it comes down to athleticism and tempo of the game, England will win. And in the end, England played into Italy's hands. It was unbelievable.
You said it there, right? If it comes down to athletic, this is a whole other thing. England are a far more athletic team.
They don't look tired.
They look fitter. And yet, who was it who slowed the tempo down? Exactly. It was England. It makes no sense.
But because that's what they did all tournament, Gab. And I know it's great to have gone that far, and you do semi-final in the World Cup 3 years ago, final in the Euros. There's progress, of course, from semis to final. Yeah, although you beat Panama, Tunisia, Colombia,
on penalties,
Sweden, Czech Republic, an old Croatia team, an end-of-cycle German team, Ukraine, and Denmark. Okay, so let's not get too carried away.
Well, I don't think
they're ready for these kind of games either, to be fair. But it's a learning progress.
The players are good enough.
Yeah, they're good enough.
Sorry. I want to touch upon something else about the penalties. Now, I made the point that, penalties are a different sport. I'm not going to say it's a lottery, whatever, because there is a skill involved. But it is a different sport. And unfortunately, the winner of the penalty kicks doesn't always reflect who deserve to win based on what we see on the pitch. I think we have to recognize that and accept that. And that would have been my excuse had Italy lost on penalties.
Yeah.
But
good excuse.
That said, I have to wonder, what was the plan on the penalty kicks? Because he brings on Rashford and Sancho with 2 minutes to go at the end of extra time.
Sancho doesn't touch the ball.
No, not just that. He brings them. This is another thing. Actually, Robbo, you were a coach. I was always taught you never make a defensive substitution when you're facing a corner kick or a set piece.
Yeah.
What does he do? Italy have a corner kick, and those two guys come on. That already struck me as odd, right?
Yeah.
And then there's like 2 minutes to go, 3 minutes to go. And then there's he's going to play a considerable amount of extra time, and he did. He played 3 minutes in a 50-minute period is a lot. And you've got Rashford and Sancho playing right back and left back. But why couldn't you, if you only want to bring him on for penalties, why not wait a little longer? Yeah. And then the penalties himself. I don't want to get into Saka argument. This guy is still, as good as he is, he's still a 19-year-old kid who's got 1.5 seasons under his belt at Arsenal.
Who had never taken a penalty before. Penalty or penalty shootout kick. Never.
Oh, you don't tell me that.
Never.
I figured he must have.
No. But he was really good at training. He was hitting them. He was scoring them at training.
He's never taken a penalty.
No.
Robbo.
If you bring a player on that's probably disappointed, Sancho's disappointed that he hasn't been brought on earlier. Rashford's disappointed. You can only bring me on to take a penalty. You can warm up as much as you like. You haven't kicked a ball. You don't have a ball on the side of the field. So the first touch they're going to have in for ages will be that penalty kick under huge pressure. In the final of the European Championship, it's an idiotic decision. You know, and as they walked up, I think the group of people I was with said, oh, these two are going to miss. They're not warmed up. They're not in the game. And that was the case with Sancho and Rashford. It was an amazing decision. And I don't know what was going through Southgate. or the coach's mind. Remember when he brought on Rashford? Rashford had to go back and ask what his role in the team was. He didn't know as he was being brought on.
Again, we were not on the pitch, so we don't know what they were, what they said to each other, a bit like for the Morata, Luis Enrique, Spain semi-final, whether he has to take it or not. But what you can clearly see on television, like from the footage, is Southgate going, you're first, you're second, you're third, you're fourth, you're fifth, you're sixth, Jordan Pickford, which, by the way, meant that had Saka scored, Jordan Pickford was the next penalty taker before Grealish, before Sterling, before Calvin Phillips, which makes even less sense. But anyway, he might well have scored, I don't know. But I would have thought, Robbo, that at some point it's more of a feeling thing than just numbers. And I don't know, maybe they had that discussion before. I don't know. I don't want to blame Southgate or anything. But in a sense that, okay, Bukayo, do you feel like being the fifth taker? Do you know what that means?
Who's going to say no? Who's going to say no at
no
that
one.
Moment?
If he tells you you're the fifth taker and you see Southgate going...
I'm sorry. Even if... And maybe you have to know the personality of the person. Even if I don't feel prepared... If I'm a professional athlete, well, Robbo, you were one. Would you ever say no?
Of course you can. You've played 120 minutes. You might got a kick. You might have cramps.
Unless you're injured. Who's going to go and say, no, boss, I don't feel. I'm actually crapping myself right now. I don't feel like taking a penalty.
But if you don't feel one, don't take it. If you don't feel it. That's the worst thing you could do is say yes when you want to say
no. But isn't the natural instinct of a footballer, Robbo, especially an English footballer, or most footballers, to say, yeah, boss. You're calling on me. I'm going to be there. I'm going to man up, right?
Yeah, but Rashford and Sancho must have known why they were being put onto the field.
No, I'm not talking. I think he's talking about them. I think he's talking about some of the others.
Yeah. Like Saka, for example.
Some of the other players. I mean, they must have done it in training. They must have said, "You're the best penalty taker. You're the fifth best penalty taker. That's how we're going to go." So that's what they went with. But to make the substitution so late and so the players are so cold, so they haven't had any touches of the ball up till that point, and now it's the biggest moment in their careers, maybe, it's a strange decision. You know, he's got a lot of things right in terms of the mentality of the players. This was one thing that he got horribly wrong.
I mean, to finish on a positive, because there are a lot of positives from this tournament for this England team. This is a team that has inspired the whole country, which is true. Not by the quality of the game that they had, the performances, but by that togetherness, by the fact that they all come from very different clubs and origins and backgrounds and all everything that you want, that united themselves to start with, and that English camp, and then the whole country, which is great. You know, you've got really good kids in that squad. And yet, What we saw in the end was disappointing, but they're going to come back stronger. You could not put them past them to win the 2022 World Cup. Now, I don't know if Southgate would be there and if he can actually take them to winning the whole thing, but there's enough talent there for it. So this should not be, and I saw Gary Lineker saying this is not the end, but it's only the beginning. Well, okay, this is a bit cliche. But certainly there's enough positive to take forward, to still be amongst the best. But I think they will have to learn from what happened in the final, because I thought, and this is my final point, I thought they had learned from 2018, the semi-final against Croatia and that disappointment. What happened in that semi-final? Trippier scored early. What happened in the final? Oh, Shaw scored early. What happened against Croatia? They're starting playing deeper and deeper and deeper, not creating anything, not having the ball. What did they do in the final? Exactly the same. What did Croatia do in the semi-final in 2018? They scored in the second half and take the game to extra time. Exactly like the Italians. What happened in extra time? The big difference is that Croatia found a way of scoring that second goal right at the end of extra time in Russia, which Italy went close but didn't do it and had to go through penalties. But this final is very much the copy of the semi-final that they lost in 2018 and that they said, oh, we've learned a lot from it. No, you haven't. Otherwise, you would have played that final very differently once you took the lead.
Maybe they have learned something, because I think England did play better in this. I'm 2018, I was really not impressed with England. Everybody's all getting all excited, right? I think they did play better in this tournament. They did have, the first 20 minutes against Croatia. They had the Germany game. Ukraine, but, they... I think there was progress compared, but it's still
not. Yeah, semi-finals to finals progress.
It's still a flaw. It's still a pretty flat learning curve. I think it needs to get steeper. But the talent is there. I think the goodwill is there. Yeah. And I don't want Southgate to go away. I want Southgate to look at what went wrong, get some help, some coaching help. I know we've heard all along what a genius this Steve Holland is. You know, maybe get somebody else in. He seems like a humble guy. Because he has all the other ingredients there, I think, to be successful, both in the team and in his own personality. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/gab. Just go to Indeed.com/gab right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/gab. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. All right, Jules, let's talk the other big continental final this week. And the one that had even more World Cups on display, right? Seven between Brazil and Argentina. Just the five between England and Italy.
Yep.
Of course, Italy contributing four of them, but that's another story. This was Argentina winners, Copa America. Lionel Messi winning, I don't want to say it's his first international trophy because
leave
he won the 2020 World Cup.
Leave me alone.
Olympics. No?
Leave me alone. His first one.
Okay, I'm going to come out and say it. I never subscribe to the argument that you can't be the GOAT because you haven't won a major trophy with your country. So to me, this doesn't move the needle one bit in terms of Messi's greatness and him belonging at the top. But to some people, it's a big deal.
It is a big deal. I think it's a big deal for Leo Messi as well.
Oh, it is for him. Yeah,
because you saw in the, not just the tears, which were fantastic. And if, like me, you woke up, I mean, wherever you are in the world, and it was worth it. Not because of the quality of the final, because it was not pretty, it was an ugly final. I think 42 fouls, 9 yellow cards.
You knew it was a very old school, I don't want to say it was a typical Copa America final. No, it's not typical.
No.
It's a very old school, stereotypical Copa America final.
Bad pitch. You know, obviously no atmosphere apart from the few fans who were allowed to be in. But you woke up at 1 a.m. in London for Messi in the hope that he will win it, just to see what it meant to him. And that didn't disappoint, because the tears, of course, the pure happiness, the pure joy, not just for him, but for the whole Argentinian squad, staff. I think they all knew how much he meant. Only twice Brazil have lost at the Maracana in their whole history, 107 years, against Uruguay in the World Cup final in 1950.
Maracanazo.
And then this time against Messi and Argentina. It's incredible. But for Messi to win it, for Argentina to win finally a trophy after 28 years since 1993, and for Messi to do it in the way he's been all through the tournament, I mean, he was even tackling in that final. You saw him doing that incredible tackle in the first half, and you were like, oh my God, he's on a mission, and he won it, and I think it's just wonderful.
I think also to put this in context, right? This is an Argentina team. Lionel Scaloni, I don't even know if he has a job on a permanent basis. For me, he's always Mr. Interim. 3 years he's been in the job after replacing Sampaoli. We know what a debacle that was. To put it in context, my friend Shergul, who is a big Fiorentina fan, he's like, man, this Argentina team, do you know they have three Fiorentina players? And he said it in a way that say, like, this Argentina team, all due respect to Fiorentina,
yeah,
not very good if you have three Fiorentina players. Now, can you name the three? I couldn't. I only got two. So
yeah,
don't feel
Martinez.
Bad. Martinez Cuarta, yes. That's the one I forgot.
Yeah. And then
Petzela and Nico.
Petzela, of course.
And
yeah,
of course, and now Nico.
Nico.
But so it is. It is special. And so much special. I do wonder, though, we hear about, you know, superb athletes, perfectionists. Do you think Messi cares one jot that he screwed up that goal with that terrible touch?
No,
I don't think he cares at all.
I tell you
what, this is the difference. Had that been Cristiano, had Cristiano won the Euros and he missed a shot like that, I bet you that keeps him up at night, and he probably goes in his cryogenic chamber and practices it over and over again.
Maybe, but I don't know. I just thought it was an incredible story, really, to see Argentina winning in that way in Brazil, as we said, for Messi too. He's 34, he turned 34 during the tournament. There's a World Cup in 15-month time that Argentina, with this kind of togetherness that they showed, the team spirit. Yeah, of course, it's not the greatest team of all time, but I think they have something special in there.
All right, Jules, we talked about Argentina. I'm not done talking about it because I got to show some love to my man, the snappy dresser, Rodrigo De Paul. That pass to Di Maria, that was special.
Yeah, although Renan Lodi makes a big mistake.
He gets lost, but still, come on, man.
Yeah, it's great. But De Paul has been fantastic through the whole tournament. That midfield, Lo Celso the same. Some friend of mine said I'd forgotten he was playing for Spurs because I've never seen him play that well for Spurs. Maybe he would play now like that kind of level. But yeah, you're right. Rodrigo De Paul was special.
Wait, who's the Spurs manager now?
Nuno.
Ah, yeah. You think he's a natural fit with Giovanni Lo Celso?
I was going to say, I'm not sure how compatible that is.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if he's on his way, personally.
The Brazilians complaining about the fact that the Argentines were very, on the ground a lot, moaning and complaining, and Chichi was not happy, and Thiago Silva was not happy. Okay, maybe, but as we said, it was an ugly final. Once they took the lead after 22 minutes or 23 minutes, you knew the way Argentina were going to try to control that game and deal with that game. But I didn't think Brazil did enough anyway. I'm not sure that Neymar can play as a sort of forced number nine or even a number nine. Why is he playing so advanced, so central? Richarlison, I'm not a big fan when you've got Firmino on the bench. Okay, Gabriel Jesus was suspended, which is a big blow. But still, there's a lot of things that Chichi could have done better or differently. Everton, I mean, what's the point of Everton?
What did he
do in that final? Nothing.
Everton are a historic club. They're the oldest club. No, yeah. Just kidding.
That's the only good thing there.
I do think a guy like Everton in a game like this, providing that sort of width,
but
not dragging the fullback.
Though. What? No cutting edge. There's nothing that he does that brings something, creates something.
I'm not that hard on him. I think it was just more, I think the occasion got to them, and I think this is disappointing as well from, I'm a big fan of Chichi, as you know.
Yeah.
And I think he had everything planned for Gabriel Jesus in his head. And for his movement, more so than for me, the other options. And he didn't adjust. And I think the early goal took the sting out of them. I also think, I don't want to blame Neymar because he gives you so much and tries to do so much and whatever. But Brazil totally lost their shape and their edge at the physicality. And you can say, but Argentina too physical. And it's fine. Sorry, Brazil, you're incomparable. You play the South American qualifiers continuously where every time you go to Paraguay, to Uruguay, to Peru, you're going to get lumps kicked out of you. Everybody's gunning for you. You're the biggest scalp in South America because you are top of the pile, because you are Brazil, because you are the Penta. So you can't use that as an excuse. You know it's coming.
I agree with you.
You know you're playing freaking Argentina, I don't buy into that. I did feel at the end, I was surprised to see Neymar, if you haven't seen it, he's on his knees. It looked like he's praying and crying at the same time. I don't know if he was asking forgiveness to his creator or what. Emotionally, this guy, whatever else you think about Neymar, this guy is emotionally invested.
He is. And of course, they won it 2 years ago in Brazil with fans. And he wasn't there because he had that ankle injury. So I think in a way, in his mind, this was his Copa America. This is the one that he had to bring to deliver to the country because he was not there 2 years ago. And I think a bit like what we were saying with Messi and the national team, there's still a bit of an issue with Neymar and this Brazilian national team because he's not the one who's delivered a World Cup or a big trophy. It is Gab. It would be the record of Pelé of the most goals scored. He will get there because he's only 28 and he's 7 or 8 behind. So he will get there. But I still think in terms of what he's brought through the years to this national team and the way the country sees him with the Auri Verde shirt, it's not at the top there yet. And I think he put a lot of pressure on himself before the final to finally deliver it. And he failed again. And I think you can understand the tears. Then there were smiles with Paredes and Di Maria and Messi as well, of course. But this one will hurt, I think, a lot.
I have to say, Jos, when I think about broader issues of club football versus international football, I think a lot of fans, a lot of our listeners, especially, maybe outside Europe and South America, they're more into their club football. A lot of people, if you ask them, would you rather win the Champions League or your country win the World Cup? Yeah. They're like, wow, And we're used to seeing a lot of players, especially I think European players, who maybe are more attached to their clubs than with them. I don't want to say more than the national team, but the feeling that they get,
different relationship.
Neymar, Messi, Cristiano, obviously with Portugal. these guys have won everything. They have all the money. They have everything you could ever want. And I don't want to say, like, hey, why do you care so much about this, right? I never see them, or I rarely see them, get this broken up about failure with their clubs. I'm not saying they're nothing less attached to their clubs or whatever, but, you know, that is a job. This is something that they really feel within. And I think it's heartwarming because we see Europe dominate so much with football and the money and so on. And these guys really have it inside them. And I think it's part of the reason why a lot of times, you know, not Brazil and Argentina, but the smaller South American sides, you know, when it comes to a World Cup and, you know, you might have Paraguay there and it's a bunch of dudes other than Roque Santa Cruz, you're like, who are these guys, you know? And yet they go out there and they go and they...
We saw Peru in the World Cup in Russia.
Yeah, absolutely.
We were both there, who hadn't reached it for like 60 years or 40 years or whatever it was.
Peru without Guerrero, of course, as well. You know, and that's a whole other issue.
But that's why we love Copa America so much. You were lucky to have covered it twice.
It is unbelievable.
None of us could go this time, but that's why we love it so much.
Unbelievable stuff.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart?
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes!
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
All right, enough Copa. How about some quick hits instead?
Let's go, Gab.
Because we celebrated Lionel Messi earlier, we are contractually obliged to tell you that Cristiano Ronaldo won the Golden Boot as the Euro 2020 top goal scorer. Now, Cristiano Ronaldo had scored 5 goals, which eagle-eyed observers will note that is as many as Patrick Schick.
It is.
But apparently you cannot share the Golden Boot. Apparently, officially, you give it to the one who had the most assists, and that would be Cristiano.
So in any leagues, like the Premier League, and we saw Aubameyang, Mane, Salah, not even just 2 players, 3 players sharing the Golden Boot, but not in Euros.
I have no idea. I don't know if this is a rule from the Muppet
is
sponsor.
Is the Golden Boot for the guy who scores the most goals?
Yes.
Or is it for the guy who scored the most goals and the most assists?
It's just the most goals, but that's the tiebreaker. Jules, it's a football.
Give two.
What do you mean give two? There's only one.
Another one. Give two. One to Patrick Schick. The poor guy is never going to win it again. This was his moment. Cristiano has won many golden boots and everything you want through the years. So give Cristiano his, of course, very important to put on the mantelpiece. And then Patrick Schick.
Jules, come on. It's one boot. It's that they don't come as a pair.
Give the right to Cristiano and the left. And one is right-footed, the other one is left-footed. So it's perfect. Right and left, you know. Gab, your boy Carlo Ancelotti has named Marcelo as the new Real Madrid captain. Is this for real, to start with? That doesn't mean he would play more, right?
But you know in the Davis Cup, you know what it means to be Davis Cup captain? You're kind of like the non-playing captain. I was wondering about that. I joke. I really like Marcelo as a guy, as a player. Obviously, at a rough time. I don't think he's going to figure big in the club's plan. He's kind of like the club captain, the leader around. It makes sense.
Listen, the oldest
thing. I'll give you a secret about Carlo, okay? His captains when he was at Milan were Franco Baresi and Paolo Maldini. And he will be the first to tell you that it's not a little stupid bit of thing around the bicep that makes you a captain. Growing up here, every time I was wondering, you know, in England, you used to have these big captaincy debates. Remember when Gary Lineker was named England captain? Oh, but can Lineker be captain because he's a striker? He's not in the thick of it? Come on, man. It's not that makes you a captain.
But I just want the best for Real Madrid. And as we know, every time Marcelo plays, we know what happens. I'm only kidding.
All right, Jules, let's get the ugliness out of the way. The FA has had to issue a statement condemning the fact that Bukayo Saka, Jadon Sancho, and Marcus Rashford, all people of color, were racially abused on social media after missing penalties. I don't think there's much to say, is there?
No, it's just a disgrace that some England fans, whatever fans you are,
we don't know. I think that they were England fans, wherever they were.
Whatever, but this should not happen anymore in 2021. We've said it many times. Something has to happen. Something has to be done for this not to happen again. Whether it's, as we said, filters, blocking accounts, blocking people. I don't know. I don't care. But this should not happen. Christian Eriksen will be back in Milan, Gab, next week. He's got a lot to think about, doesn't he?
Yeah, and Inter have said very clearly, take all the time you need to think about it. Simone Inzaghi said, you know, come back to training if you want to, if it's safe. Don't come back if it's not. I mean, at some point, they will have to make
a decision. Yeah,
he'll have to make a decision. Yeah. But I think the great thing is he wants to come back and be a part of it. He wants to be around. He wants to talk to people. Like honestly, you know, he's a quiet guy. I mean, his personality matches the way he looks, right? But he's such a warm guy, and I think after what he's been through, he's so excited to be back, to be around people. You saw it with his Denmark teammates.
You can imagine, yeah.
Now with Inter as well. Mm. Ronald Koeman wouldn't confirm that Antoine Griezmann is part of his plans at Barcelona. So it was a horrible accent. Jules, what does this mean he's not part of his plans?
Well, I mean, that means, which we knew, that if there's a good offer for Griezmann, I think the club would listen to.
Yeah, and if my aunt had wheels, she'd be a bicycle. Yeah. If.
I know, if. Because we can tell Ronald Koeman and Barcelona that we don't think this is going to happen. No one is going to come in and offer 80 million for a 30-year-old Antoine Griezmann after the season that he's had and after the Euros that he's had.
And with the salary that he has, that's the big thing.
Let's remind everyone that Antoine Griezmann earns 800,000 Euros a week, and that's a lot of money for any club, and especially for Barcelona. I don't know who gave him his contract, but I mean, come on.
Can we contextualize this? Antoine Griezmann makes more than twice what Kevin De Bruyne makes.
Exactly.
Okay, let's just let that sink in, which is also more than twice what Paul Pogba makes, which is, I think, nearly three times what Harry Kane makes.
Harry Kane.
Let that sink in.
Someone gave him that deal.
Yeah. Nobody's going to come and give him that money. No. That's Gareth Bale money. Yeah.
That's a loan maybe. But again, who's going to take him on loan? I mean, I don't think this is going to go anywhere. And again, Barcelona face a lot of issues financially, as we've been saying for a few weeks now.
I have an idea. Why don't Paris Saint-Germain take him on loan after they sell Kylian Mbappe to Real Madrid so he doesn't leave them on a free at the end of the season? No.
No chance. But it's a good try. My boy Olivier Giroud is expected in Milan this week, Gab, to sign for AC Milan. Is that a wise move for the Rossoneri, do you think?
I think so. I think he's a really good teammate. Yep. I think he still has a lot to give. You know, Ibrahimovic isn't going to play every game. I don't think you need to worry about designing wacky schemes where they both play together. I think they'll just share the playing time. I think both can keep playing for a while. Giroud, obviously, a lot younger. And I think signing fits the bill.
He's very excited, I can tell you that.
Why wouldn't you be? You get to go to 2 years to Milan.
And a two-year deal as well. You know, at 34, going 35 in September. Happy days.
Achraf Hakimi has signed for Paris Saint-Germain. But Jules, we knew this. That's not the point. That's not what the question is. Okay. The question is, do you feel a little bit dissed when his agent comes out and says that he's still dreaming of a return to Real Madrid?
He's 22. Do you really think he's going to stay 10 years in Paris? As much as I would love you, Achraf, to do that, I don't think so. I think eventually he will stay, give us some really good years, win the Champions League with us, and then he can go back to Real Madrid. We can sell him for 60, 70, 80, 100 million euros.
Maybe once Marcelo retires, he can go to Real Madrid.
Yeah. Oh, good idea. Good idea. Juan Mata signed a one-year deal extension at Manchester United, Gab. He jokes that he means Bruno Fernandes will have to wait another year at least to get the number 8 shirt. But does that make sense to you? I mean, we love Juanito. Of course we do. Everybody does.
Okay. So Juan Mata he's intelligent. He's a gentleman. He's committed to charity. He's done so many great things. But I think he still has something to give, you know, on the football pitch.
Yeah, I agree.
I just don't know that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer thinks he has something to give, because otherwise, if he did, he would have played him more last season and he wouldn't have signed Jadon Sancho.
Yeah.
And he's a squad player, good guy to have across the group. I would have hoped that Mata would have gone somewhere else so he could play more.
Yeah.
You know, because I want to see Mata play. And if he can't play at United level, let it be somewhere else. But to have Mata be on the squad list and not get on the pitch, that makes me a little bit sad. Sergio Ramos's move to Paris Saint-Germain was a slow burn. Now it's done. Jules, let me ask you again how you feel about this.
I'm so pumped. I mean, I saw his video yesterday doing monkey bars in his red pants, and I'm just like red, which is obviously one of the colors of Paris. And I was like, yes, yes, come and bring us leadership, quality, grinta, cojones, everything you want. Please come. Rui Patricio is Roma's new goalkeeper. Gab, are you on board? Are you impressed?
I think in the end, I think the fee is, it's funny because one of those things where like in England, they're saying, oh, it's going to be about 15 million euros, and in Lithuania, it's going to be about 10 million euros. Whatever it is, they need a live body. He's not a bad goalkeeper.
No, he's not,
He obviously, it does feel like this is part of the further mendicification of Roma, and that's disappointing. But they need somebody. So let it be him. Robin Olsen ain't coming back. Ajax goalkeeper Andre Onana is reportedly close to a move to Lyon. Jules, if you haven't been following the chronicles of Onana, of course, he's coming off a suspension, right? For performance-enhancing
products.
Which seemed a bit... It's a strange story. Let's not waste time on that. But I am left confused. And I don't know if this is a new French fashion, of course. France on the cutting edge of football. No, no.
Here we go.
Tell me this, okay? So Paris Saint-Germain have two top goalkeepers, three actually, right? If you count Alphonse Areola, right?
Yeah.
So they have Keylor Navas. So they decided to get Donnarumma as well. So
great
market
opportunity.
Yeah, you create a market opportunity where you buy everybody.
Market opportunity.
Supermarkets work that way. So Marseille as well, right? They have the legendary Steve Mandanda and his brothers. And then they decide to add Paulo Lopez.
On loan. And Mandanda is like 55 years old.
He's not 55 years old. I think 36. He's 36.
Yeah.
So that's fine. Now Lyon are doing the same thing. Now what... They already have Anthony Lopez. He's 30 years old. You can't say he's old.
No.
He's a very good goalkeeper.
He is.
Right? You need to get Onana, too.
Because Peter Bosch, your friend, your favorite manager, wants a keeper that plays more with the ball, better with his feet, which Onana is. Remember, he works with Onana Ajax. He knows him well. I think he might even have given him his debut.
This is the Peter Bosch.
Peter Bosch, yeah.
He probably wouldn't like Stekelenburg very
much. And Onana is on quite a low price because of that suspension, because I think
his contract is expiring as well. Yeah,
that's why. So, market opportunity again.
Yeah, but it's going to be worth nothing if you get him and he sits on the bench behind Lopez.
No, I know, but we are the League of Talents and also
the League of
goalkeepers in big clubs. That's where we are. Benfica president Luis Felipe Vieira is under house arrest, Gab. He was arrested and paid a €3 million bail to get out and now has to stay in his house for being investigated for tax fraud and money laundering, all sort of that. That seems really serious, Gab.
It does seem serious.
It's bad.
Manuel Rui Costa, who was vice president, is now taking over at Benfica. Obviously, Benfica, a different setup for people who don't know. In Portugal, Luis Felipe Vieira doesn't own the club. You know, it's an elected position, blah, blah, blah. But it's still bad because he'd been there a while. It's an embarrassment for the club. He's a very senior figure. And the other thing, and our colleague at the New York Times, Tarek Pena, has written about this extensively, Benfica is a major institution beyond football. You know, the amount of judges, politicians, entrepreneurs, people in the media who really identify with this.
Yeah.
You know, this is a major stain unless he can go and clear his name. And the fact that the judiciary went after him in this way, I think, is very significant.
Because he's accused to have stolen money from the club that got paid to his, like, offshore accounts and stuff like that. It's a very ugly story.
Jules, we're going to end the show today by saluting our friend and colleague, Paul Mariner, who left us on Friday, age 68. Of course, Paul, former legend for Arsenal, for England, 1982 World Cup, but a far better person.
Far better person, a gentleman. And I will ask you your tribute because you knew him better than me and you met him when I only worked with him through the television, never really met him in person. But it was always... such a gentleman, so respectful, so encouraging when you were, you know, a young journalist like me, starting with ESPN, and he was always great. And the world is a worse place without him now.
Yeah, no question. I mean, a real class act. I was always struck by Paul had so many interests outside football.
Mm.
You know, we have a stereotype of the English footballer from a certain era. That was not Paul. He loved his rock and roll. There's a book coming out, which he wrote sort of in his last days with Mark Donaldson, which, you know, incredible stories in it, no question about it. And he definitely leaves a gap because he was so welcoming and such a good person and loved to listen and loved to talk.
Yeah.
Rest in peace, Paul. Right, that brings us to an end. We'll be back on Thursday. Until then, love the game, love your neighbor, love yourself.